Well, this is going to be our last tape on the subject of multiple wives, and I want to look a little bit at the history of the family and introduce you to a big problem in our society that multiple wives would solve. Now, having said that, I think the biggest problem we have in the United States is not necessarily the government. I think it lies in the fact that we no longer have strong families as we once had in this country. In other words, nationally, we are suffering from the effects of the deterioration of the family unit. Now, the family consists basically of two units, a husband and a wife that makes up the marriage and all that it stands for, and two children. And there are two functional units here. The marriage would stand separate from the family in that a married man and a woman have a relationship with each other that the children are not privileged to be a part of. And yet marriage is also a part of the family in that the marriage provides the headship of the family, wherein the man and the woman have separate duties and responsibilities, and yet they also have responsibilities towards their children, and likewise their children have certain responsibilities toward them. And so the children then have the headship in the father and the mother, and the mother or the wife actually has her headship in the husband, and the husband has his headship in the Christ. And of course we read of this headship in Ephesians chapter 5. Now the family has always been the basic unit and the strength of every society of people that ever amounted to anything. And a society without strong families will eventually erode into history as the other societies before it. Now, certainly we can see the strong family unit at work in the model of all societies, that being the Israel nation of the Bible, because there they had the family unit basically as I have described it to you. And of course, Israel was itself one great big family, is because everybody descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or Israel, and of course from his sons, the 12 sons of Israel. And so Israel grew, though. They became a nation of people with God as their head. And when Israel finally quit marching around Mount Sinai and moved into the Promised Land, we do not find them occupying a land in some helter-skelter method. I want this piece, you want that piece, go take it, whatever. No, we don't find that. We find the land was divided and parceled out first to the tribes and then down to each separate unit family. Now, excuse me. Each separate family then, within a tribe, though, consisted of one man who is the head of the family. It consisted of his wife or his wives, his maidservants, his concubines, and their children, and of course, he may have had some manservants. And this is what we would call an extended family of sorts, a family that lived on a specific piece of land and governed by the principal male heir of that particular family. And under this extended family unit, Israel grew, didn't they? They grew strong. They grew into a great nation that was feared by other nations. And each family had a sense of togetherness and a common direction or purpose. And the tribe likewise had a sense of togetherness and a common direction or purpose. And so did the nation of Israel as a whole. And all were under one head, the head being God, of course. And this is basically the system that our own country was developed under. And I'm old enough to know about the extended families that existed in the days of my youth. Now, I'll give you an example of this, because one of my grandfathers owned a tract of land. He had a wife, and eventually they come to have three sons and three daughters, and I think they had a couple miscarriages. Now, in the younger days of the children, the father and the mother worked like horses, beavers, horses, to keep things going. As the children got older, though, each was assigned specific things that they could do. I mean, farm work was tough in those days. There was cows to get in twice daily, and that had to be fed, they had to be milked, they had to be doctored, butter had to be churned, candles and soap were not bought at the store, they were made in the home. There were chickens to feed and eggs to gather, there were meals to prepare, tables to set, dishes to wash, not to mention the piles of dirty laundry over there in the corner that needed washing and ironing without a washing machine and a dryer. There were fields to plow, to plant, to cultivate, to irrigate, and to harvest. There were horses to take care of. There were barns to be cleaned. There was hay to be put inside those barns. It had to be stored inside. There was wood to gather. It had to be cut. It had to be stored for the winter, or there could be no heat in the house. There were floors. What would you do with them? Sweep and mop them, obviously. A garden had to be planted. It had to be spaded first, planted, watered, weed. Had somebody got to weed this thing and harvested. There was canning to do of all kinds of fruits and vegetables and even meats on occasion. Jams and jellies were made. Bread was made and cinnamon rolls. These things were not bought in the corner grocery store, not to mention things like pies, cakes, and candy. It was all homemade. Then there were onions, there were potatoes, there were carrots, and there were apples, and all these things had to be dug up and put into boxes or picked off the trees and stored into a cellar. Everybody had a cellar in those days. Indoor plumbing was unknown, and water had to be pumped by hand and heated on the stove for bath and dishes. There were clothes to make and mend and blankets to make, pillows to make, and even mattresses were made at home. The work never ended, as everything was labor-intensive and it had to be done, else the family would perish. They worked hard. They lived hard. They played hard. And although there were squabbles among the family members, the family was united and they all had a common sense of purpose. Survival. Absolutely survival. Now, this may not have been the way they saw it at that particular time, but that's the way it was. And all this work, and even more, which I have mentioned to you, had to be accomplished by one man and one woman in the beginning, and then as things moved along, by their daughters and sons. Now, after listening to this list of chores that had to be done, and there was more that we could put on the list, is anybody tired out there besides me? Now, by today's standards, their family was quite large. They had 6 children. But it needed to be large because of all the work that had to be done. And the same was true of most farm families, as they could not afford to hire laborers to work on their farms. And so children were almost an absolute necessity. And the husband longed for the day when his sons would be old enough to help with the heavy labor. And the wife did the same thing, because as the daughters got older, more and more of the work could be assigned to them. And I know that life was especially rugged for the wife, because she would have to accomplish her work while also being pregnant. And in this case, she spent almost 5 years in pregnancy, and that's not counting the 2 miscarriages. I don't know how long those were. And all of this is under trying circumstances, and this is understandable that she would have miscarriages. But they increased the amount of time that she was pregnant, of course. And once the child was born, it took an awful lot of her time, and yet the work still had to be accomplished. And as I look back on this, I can certainly see how the having of more than one wife could have made things easier for all concerned. Now, I wasn't there, grant you, but these stories were told to me, the things that they did. And I witnessed some of this. I witnessed my grandmother making blankets and mattresses. I slept on a homemade mattress for years. But today, things have drastically changed. And today, we have corporate farms. And 100 years ago, 90% of the people lived on and worked on those farms. And 10% was in the cities. But today, it's just the opposite. 90% of the people live and work in the cities, while 10% of the people work on farms, live and work on farms. And so we have moved basically from an agricultural society to an industrial and business-oriented society. And in this society, the majority of people are not self-sufficient because they work for someone other than themselves. Now, in days gone by, we could say that the family was a slave to the land, I guess. And today's family is basically a slave to the corporation or whomever they work for. In days gone by, the family controlled to a great degree their destiny and the things that they could do. If they wanted to quit work for a day, they could do that. But you don't do that in the corporate world unless you get time off. But so today, basically, the corporation, again, determines the destiny of most people. Now, in days gone by, the husband could adequately support his family. They always had food. It's one thing that we had when I was a child, it was food. But today, things in our country have progressed to the point that unless the husband is an awful high-paid professional, it's almost impossible for the family to survive on a single income. And so the wife, what did she have to do? She had to enter into the workforce, didn't she, just in order to support the family. And so when the wife becomes pregnant, it means a loss of income at some point in time. And so as soon as possible after the child is born, she must, out of financial necessity, get back into the workforce. And this financial necessity, I guess for all practical purposes, has destroyed the strong family unit that this country once had. I don't think it takes a magician or a rocket scientist to know that the best people in the world to raise a child would be the mother and the father. But today, at a very early age, most children are shuttled off to daycare centers where the child will spend perhaps 8, 10, 12 hours a day of its waking hour looking at or being looked after by various surrogate mothers hired by the daycare center. And these surrogate mothers are not just looking after one child apiece, but many children from many different families, and of course all at the same time, and they all come from different socio-economical backgrounds. Not only that, but studies tell us that the children in daycare centers have a far greater chance of physical, mental, or sexual abuse than they do in the home. In fact, the chances of such thing happening in the daycare center is over 40 times greater. That's right, 40 times greater. This certainly does not speak very well of placing our children in daycare centers, does it? But what are the alternatives? Well, for most families, they have no other choice, even though the cost of this daycare center takes a huge chunk out of the mother's salary. It's almost like another huge, heavy tax they have to pay in order to be able to survive. Now, Also, in days gone by, the mother would be the primary raiser of the children, and with Dad pitching in when he was not working. It was also not unusual for children to learn to read and write in the home. But today, this activity is now accomplished in daycare centers. And when the child is old enough, it enters into what's called the public school system, a thing I have often labeled as the public fools system. And I have done so because we are fools. We are fools to place our children in such institutions, because that's just what they are. They're institutions. They might as well be prisons. Institutions in which the government teaches its children what it wants them to learn. And we send our children, and this is sad, folks, we send our children to these institutions with instructions. And those instructions are, you will listen to your teacher, you will do what they tell you to do, and you will learn what they teach you. And so, all in one sentence, we have made surrogate mothers out of teachers. Fathers, too, I guess, if the teacher's a male. Surrogate mothers that train and nurture the child as the teacher sees fit, not how the parent sees fit. And if these surrogate mothers have any children, well, they do have many children. These surrogate mothers do have. They have many children to deal with in the course of a day. And it's impossible for them to have any kind of emotional tie with these children whatsoever. And so what we have done, ladies and gentlemen, is we have given teachers basically a license to steal. It's not really theft, but it's a kind of an analogy here. We've given them a license to steal what a child should learn and replace that knowledge with the socialization of the child and what government wants for our children or for their children. I say that because it seems to me that the primary function of the public school system is to prepare children to live in and exist in a total socialistic society. And as for the character of our children, well, now it's going to be determined to a great degree by the child's interaction with those whom it comes in contact with at the public school system. And certainly, my friends, if you expect your child to develop a godly character, it will not come to pass in the public schools. Forget it. But what is the alternative to the family? Well, there is a groundswell movement in this homeschool issue, isn't there? Which we should all applaud and support, by the way. But when mothers do stay home and attempt to educate their children, there are some real trade-offs. Yes, the child receives love. It receives a godly orientation. But at what price? Some mothers find they cannot work at a job and adequately teach their children at home at the same time. And so then they have to quit their job. And the cost of the mother staying home to do so creates a rather sharp drop in the family standard of living. Sharp drop. And we're not talking perhaps here totally about necessities. Luxuries, I'll get it. We're not talking necessarily about total luxuries. We're also talking about, in many cases, a reduction of necessary things. Not to mention the loss of the family's ability to do other things with their money, like save it and to accumulate capital. Because unless they can accumulate capital, then things like a college education for their children may be out of the question. Now, I point out all of these shortcomings to you for a purpose, obviously, as all of them could be eliminated if the man had more than one wife. It's like the farm situation we looked at earlier. The more women that's in that family, the more women that a man had, the more work could be distributed among those women, and the more sons he could have to help with the hard labor sooner. And the same would be true today with multiple family wives, as there would be more people available to share the workload of the family. With, say, two, three, or four wives, the distribution can be divided in many ways. For example, perhaps one wife loves being a homemaker, whereas another may enjoy working in the workforce. So both of them can have their way. And so with these kind of options available to the family, there would always be someone to provide adequate care for the children, regardless of which wife was the actual mother. And the children could be taught at home as long as deemed appropriate before sending it off to the public school system. In addition, with one or two wives in the workforce, maintaining an adequate income for the family is no longer a problem. And the family should have money left over to save and invest for not only their future, but also for the future of their children, if they want to send them to college and things. And the husband who may have been working full-time at one job and perhaps part-time at another job, no longer needs to work excessively or excessive amount of hours, and he will have much more time to spend at home with his wife and children. In other words, he would have more time to be a good husband and a father to their children. There are also many benefits of multiple wife families that would spill over into society as a whole, because with a larger workforce in the home, there are more people to become involved with community activities, which would never, by the way, should have been institutionalized by the state, because those organizations have today become the largest bloodsuckers of the fruits of our labor that ever existed, as we are taxed, and we are taxed heavily to support them. Now, when I was a child, the majority of these kind of activities were accomplished by benevolent-type organizations, and I don't know the name of them, but all of them, but they're Lions and the Elk, and I guess Moose and whatever. But today, most of these organizations, because government has taken over this job, have resorted to sponsoring things like Little League baseball and football. Okay. The multiple wife family could also free up both men and women who might be more inclined to get involved with these community activities, okay? Not to mention the fact that more good men would become available to serve in public offices. And why not? Why shouldn't they? Well, they should. And why? They should do so because today's people who serve in these public offices make a career out of living off the teats of the government cow. And they could care less about the people, contrary to what they may tell us. And many of these people only entered politics because they had not been able to succeed or to survive in the private sector in a manner of their liking. And so they turned to the public trough. We need better men filling public offices. But how many men are able to do so? How many men have the time to do so? And of course, in our economical system, not only does he not have the time to seek office, he also can't afford to seek public office. It costs too much.
And now I'm going to switch directions a little bit. You see, in studying this issue, I spent a great deal of time on the Internet. I did so trying to find materials on the subject. As it turned out, I was amazed at the amount of information that was available out there. But at looking at the materials available to me, I was constantly running into sites where men and women advertise themselves, you know, dating service or whatever they're called. And it was not long before I realized that there are not just hundreds of these sites, but I think there's thousands of them out there. And that told me several things. Number one, single men and women are both having a problem finding suitable mates. As I looked at some of these sites, I immediately noticed that there are far more women seeking men to marry than there are men seeking women to marry. And the ratio is really quite large. On most websites, it's at least 2 to 1. There's 2 women on every site for every man on a site. And it goes up to high as 4, 5, and 6 times as many. It also did not take me too long to figure out that age was a significant factor. And I can understand that, because the younger we are, the more opportunities there are for both men and women to marry. And this is true because of a very high percentage of the people in the younger age groups that are not married yet. Now, in searching for additional information on the subject, I finally came across some data for Great Britain or the United Kingdom. And it reported on the population of the nation and the problems that women over there are having finding marriageable men. Now, this study said the total population of the nation consists of 48% men and 52% women. Now, that's a 4% spread, right? Now, the study also pointed out that in numbers, whole numbers, there is 1.5 million surplus of women in the nation. And that means there are simply no men for 4% of the women to marry. That is, unless they can steal some other woman's husband. Now, from these figures, I was able to determine that the married and the marriageable female population in England would be close to 40 million people. 40 million women, I guess I should say. Now, I found all this very interesting anyhow, so I decided to look up numbers for the United States, and so I checked out the U.S. Census report. And their figures since 1990 show a difference in the male-female population. It shows that it varies around 6 million, a little over, a little under. And their figures for 1999 show a total population of 272.7 million, with 133.3 males and 139.4 females. And that means there are 6.1 million more women than men. Did you get that? There are 6.1 million more women than men in the United States of America. That's staggering. Now, percentage-wise, the male population is 48.9% of the total, and the female population is 51.1% of the total population, which is, percentage-wise, just about as close as you can get to the population figures in the United Kingdom. Now, this census report also shows that the percentage of the population under 18 is 25.7% of the total, And that would mean there are 103.57 million women of marriageable age. They may already be married, but they're of the marriageable age. Over 18 is what I'm counting there. And there are 99.30 million men who are of the marriageable age. Now, let's subtract the two figures, and what do we come up with? We come up with 4.3 million women in the United States of America above the ages of 18 for whom men are simply not available. They don't exist. Now, that's quite a shocking statistic, wouldn't you say? Now, because there are 4.3 million women in our country for whom men of a marriageable age simply do not exist, what has this done? Well, it has created a large amount of single women who are available for men to date and to have sex with without having to get married. In other words, the imbalance in the population is getting worse and worse as time goes on because of these ever-increasing numbers of men who now have more opportunity to have sexual relationships outside of marriage. Men and women both want attention, and especially women. They want a man. Now, the availability, or this availability, maybe I should say, this availability of excess women has caused an increase in the amount of men who do not need to get married, as one of the strongest motivators for men to marry is to satisfy an uncontrollable sex urge. And I guess I'd better explain here what I mean when I say a man's sex urge is uncontrollable. I mean that a man's urge is never satisfied, as it is a call of nature. It's just like eating, it's like drinking, it's like sleeping, it's like going to the bathroom. The urge for all these things are beyond his control, the urge, that is. He must have them or he must do them. But what man does is attempt to control the exercising of that urge. But anyhow, if a man can satisfy his sex urge without getting married, then there is no compelling need for him to marry. But what I want to emphasize here is the fact that an increase in the amount of men who will not marry increases the number of women who cannot marry. Okay. Now, a very large amount of men also tend to marry women who are from 2 to 4 years younger than they are. And this means that even when a woman becomes marriageable, the population of single men, single available men, I guess I should say, becomes even less. And the younger the age women are allowed to marry, the worse the problem becomes. For example, in Russia, women are allowed to marry at age 16, which makes the availability later on of men even worse. Now, I found all these statistics very interesting. And there's also a difference in the statistics for women in the marriageable ages and in women who are older than the marriageable age. Now, that's quite unique, of course, but as I mentioned, some 4% or some 1.5 million women in the United Kingdom simply have no man to marry. But when women are above the marriageable age, the percent rises to 23%. That's correct. 23% of the women over the marriageable age simply have no men to marry. Now, I've got to give you a definition here. I don't really know what it is because I'm having to do some guesswork here. Because the study I read did not define marriageable age. But in the United States, I imagine it would be from about 18 to 25, I would say. You know, out of high school and then out of college. Somewhere along in there. Now, wars also have a devastating effect on the availability of men. The United States had this problem, especially after the Civil War, where around 600,000 men were killed. And there were more men killed in the Civil War than all the other total wars combined. Of course, we were losing men on both sides in that particular war. Nevertheless, World War I and World War II also had an impact on the availability of men in the United States. And because I was a history major, I also know that World War II had a big impact on the country of Russia. Now, I do not remember the source, but I do remember reading about this, and the availability of men was so low after the war that the government actually encouraged men to have more than one wife. Now, since I remember that, I tried to document it, but I was unsuccessful in doing so at this time, but I suspect that they rewrote the history books by now. But I noticed from recent news stories about Russia that they're not inclined to do that today. But anyhow, if that was true after World War II, it would certainly have solved the problem of having more women than men. Now, this brings me to the conclusion of this particular study, which was this, and I'll read this to you. A seemingly small excess of women can have a large effect on the society. A seemingly small excess of women can have a large effect on the society. Also, I found it interesting that the study went on to conclude, and this is what I really found interesting, and again, I'll quote to you here, the availability of polygamy works against this, and so it is unsurprising to note that polygamous societies have historically had lower rates of fornication, adultery, prostitution, and abortion than our own. That's right. He says, let me read this again. It's interesting to note that polygamous societies have historically had lower rates of fornication, adultery, prostitution, and abortion than our own. So, what does that tell you? That tells you when you've got a surplus of women, there's more women available for these things to go on. Fornication, adultery, and prostitution, see? And, of course, abortion would be the same thing. Now, I do not know about you, but I find all of this very interesting, to say the least. And for these 4.3 million women of marriageable age, now some of these women are married, grant you. No, this is the ones that are not married, pardon me. These 4.3 million women are of marriageable age. The situation is not good for them, and it's getting worse year by year because there's simply no men for them to marry. The situation is even worse in the religious community because according to research published in another magazine called Religious Trends, which is a Christian handbook, in the average church congregation, and again, this is in the United Kingdom, but we've seen that their statistics are pretty close to ours, but in the average church congregation in the United Kingdom, single women outnumber men by more than 2 to 1. By more than 2 to 1. That's the total. Another report, though, this time in Christianity magazine, says that church-going women are being forced, listen to this, being forced to stay single because they cannot find partners who match their high moral standards. And so what's a woman to do? There's no men there. And the situation does not improve as they get older. In fact, it gets worse. As by age 40, there are as many as 4 single women to every single man in the church. And by the age of 50, this becomes 6 single women to every single man. We've got a lot of women out there without male companionship. You see what I'm trying to say here? And we wonder why we have adultery. We wonder why we have promiscuous relationships. And we wonder why we have abortions. Of course, at age 50 and 60, you're not going to see too many of those abortions. But nevertheless, you can see why we're having more of a promiscuous society. Now, obviously, many of the men who are unmarried at this age have been left that way for some reason. And the reason being that women do not see these men as good husband material, meaning that the ratio for women is effectively much worse than is actually reported. And as a result, many Christian women are also turning to dating services. But friends, this isn't going to change that much because the fact of the matter is the numbers are against them. In the United Kingdom, there's a surplus, again, of 1.5 million women, and we have a surplus in the United States of 4.3 million women, for which there are simply no men available. Okay, that concludes the information that I found on the Internet. Now, what I have learned from this study is that this population imbalance affects both men and women. It does so in different and opposite ways. Now, as a woman, she has to deal with the fact that there are 4.3 million women in the United States of America of a marriageable age for whom marriageable men simply do not exist. Now, that's something to cope with. And that does not take into consideration the men who are of marriageable age and yet are not considered as marriageable material. I will also mention that none of these figures include the large sodomite population in this country, and that also would increase the number of men who fall into the category of men who are undesirable for marriage. And so if a woman is over the age of 25, then she may well fall into a worse category, as then the percentage increases from 4% of the population, the marriageable population, to 23% of the marriageable age population. Too many marriageables in here. Now, I'm missing some figures in here because the study that I read didn't give me the information that I needed, but I estimated that a 23% disparity rate may well mean that there are 7.5 million women above the marriageable age for which no marriageable men are available. And that's taking into consideration the sodomites and men who are just not acceptable for marriage. And, of course, this doesn't mean there's a total absence of men out there, does it? Because there are men out there. But as the statistics clearly show, there is a preponderance of women to men. And from a woman's perspective, especially if she's over 25 years of age, she's not only going to have a difficult time finding a marriageable man, but also of the men who are available that she's going to be able to date and interact with, her problem is at least twofold. Number one, do these men really want to get married, or are they playing the field? And number two, are these men, that when she sorts those out, are these men actually marriageable material? Those are two big problems for her. Hey, listen, boys, from a man's perspective, he's living in paradise. He's living in paradise. And I should say that the vast majority of men do marry, but we also have a pretty healthy divorce rate, don't we? Somewhere between 30 and 50%, depending on who you talk to. But anyhow, with 4.3 million women out there, the majority of which want husbands, want male companionship, to men, the field is ripe for the picking. As men have an overabundant supply of women who cannot marry because men for these 4.3 million women in our country simply do not exist. And so it's open season on single women for men. Because that means single man's opportunities for dating is vastly increased, isn't it? And so does the opportunity then for him to have sexual satisfaction outside of marriage. These women are starving for attention. And as the study pointed out, this decrease in the amount of men willing to marry increases the number of women who cannot marry. Now, looking at this from a multiple wife perspective, or polygamy, which is the nasty word, a man who wants to have another wife can have all the wives he and his family can support. Right? What does this do for the man, though? Well, number one, it satisfies his lust for a woman, and it satisfies his uncontrollable sex urge. A multiple wife family also has a better opportunity to get ahead financially. The children can be brought up in a loving home environment rather than in a cold-hearted daycare center and in the public school system. It frees up the man's time to allow him more time to spend with his wives and children. And, of course, the list could go on. Now, from a single woman's standpoint, a single woman who wants to get married, that is, and cannot find a suitable husband, well, guess what? She immediately has a huge increase of men that are available to her for marriage, as any man in the country is now within her grasp, any man. And so collectively, it means for the 4.3 million women for which men simply do not exist, that men now exist for these women, and they are not forced to live out their lives alone, they are not forced to live out their lives without love and without the protection and security of a husband. And lastly, from a national perspective, allowing men to have multiple wives tends to solve this population imbalance problem. Now, I'm not trying to say that allowing men to have multiple wives will instantly solve a social crisis in this area, because it will not. But I think that if such were permissible and it came to pass, then over time it would significantly reduce the numbers to an insignificant number. And not every man out there is going to have a multiple wife. You're just not going to have more than probably about 10% of the population that would even engage in such a thing. At least that's what I've read. I'm also not trying to say that this would immediately solve all of our social ills. But again, I also think that in time it would do a lot to reduce them. Because if you remember in the conclusion of the study, we saw that, I'm going to quote this again, polygamous societies have historically had lower rates of fornication, adultery, prostitution, and abortion than our own. And with a reduction in those problem areas, perhaps the strength of the American family could be restored. So there is a big plus here. Now, there is another thing I would like to consider in this imbalance of the population, which gives this nation a very large surplus of women who want to marry and can't. The reasons they want to doesn't really concern me, but obviously women may want some companionship of a man and a marriage relationship with a man. So this includes, of course, the intimacies of being held close as well as a sexual relationship. And a lot of women desire marriage just because they want to have children. Just because they want to have children. In fact, it was surprising to find so many women around 30 years of age, a little over 30, who now say they've had their fling at the business world and they want to have children before they get any older. I know this was true in one of our own daughter's case. She never had any children until she was 30. But what is a woman who wants to marry to do in order to find a marriageable man when she's out of these statistics, when she's in that 25 or age group or older? Does she hang a sign around her neck with the words on, "I'm available for marriage"? Of course, I have a bass. I need to be a soprano, I guess. But no, she does not do that. And about all she can do to make herself available at places where single men might be. And oh, the first thing someone's going to say is, well, go to church. But we've already seen the statistics are worse for her to find a marriageable man in the church than just about anywhere else. You know, anywhere from 2 to 4 to 6 to 1 of women looking for a man in church. But okay, she's tried that, we'll say, and to no avail. And of course, then there's the nightclub and the bar scene, but the pickings there are what, poor to none, something like that. One thing she can do, and it's amazing how many women do so, and that is to advertise herself on these hundreds or thousands of internet websites for singles. And she does that. And again, she does so with negative results because of the problems before. Most of these men are not really looking for women to marry. They're looking for women to have a game with or to play with. So what's next for her? Social clubs, fitness clubs, and so on? And she still cannot find a marriageable single man that she considers marriageable material. Remember, she's short 4.3 million men out there to choose from. Now, believe it or not, this is a big problem for single women. And as I was looking at some of these things on the internet, I cannot believe some of the comments that I was reading. Well, yes, I can. I mean, here's, for example, I'll give you a few things that I found on some of these ads. So, are all the good ones gone? Where are all the nice guys? What happened to honest men? Where have all the gentlemen gone? Will somebody explain to me what the deal is with men? Is there no one out there who wants more? Whatever happened to chivalry and cuddles and walks in the rain? Now, this is just typical of things that you find out here on these internet sites. And that should give you some idea as to the problems women are faced in looking for marriageable men. They are starving for marriageable men. And again, there are 4.3 million of them. And the vast majority are seeking a marriage. But for these 4.3 million women, statistically, there are no men available. Unless they steal someone else's husband. Now this brings me to the last subject just about, I guess, I want to talk about in this area. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 2, 8, and 9. And I'm still on the statistical thing, but anyhow, I want to throw in scripture here. Verse 2, nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. I say therefore, verse 8, I say therefore to the unmarried and the widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. Now, based on this and based on the statistic that we've seen, what is our 4.3 million women to do? They cannot find marriageable men, and yet they still yearn for male companionship. And Paul says to avoid fornication, let every woman have her own husband. But she has looked and looked and to no avail. And besides that, the numbers are against her. And she's having a problem. She's having a problem containing herself. She's burning for desire. And Paul says, let them marry. But again, Paul, marry who? You know, unfortunately, these women really do not know that there are 4.3 million more women in our society than men. They don't know that, and that's why they can ask some of these questions. You know, where are the nice guys? So where are the good ones gone? Sweetheart, they're all taken for the most part. Now, this situation is not unique to our day and age, and I have given you some of the reasons, though, for this imbalance in the population. But the same problem existed in biblical days. But in those days, there was a remedy for women, because in those days, the custom was a man could have as many wives as he could support. But for the last 500 years, or maybe 1,000 for all I know, man, by his traditions, has changed what was a very practicable, a very workable, and a very God-sanctioned remedy for this problem. And they've turned them into societies in which the norm has become one man and one woman, which leaves all these other women out there to flounder without men. And when society started this custom, then it was inevitable that as time progressed, there will always be an ever-increasing amount of women for which statistically there are simply no men to marry. Now, women, you can relate to this. At least, I know you don't want your man to have another wife because we've been brought up that way. But just stop and think about these women out there. What if you were one of these 4.3 million women, see? You know, what would your solution be? To sit home, you know, and wait for somebody? It isn't going to happen, see? And so what the traditions of men have created is a situation today where 4.3 million women in the United States are forbidden to marry. They're forbidden to marry because there are no men there. Not because they do not want to marry. No, because society denies them men to marry. Our rules, our customs, and our tradition denies them men to marry. And this has been accomplished not only by custom, but by man's law, by passing these bigamy laws. But perhaps this is a fulfillment of what Paul said in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 13. 1 Timothy 4:13. He said, in latter times some shall depart from the faith. This is verse 1, I guess, not 13. It's Timothy 4, verses 1 through 3. In the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry, and commanding to abstain from meats and so on. It seems to me that today it is no longer some shall depart from the faith, as now it is the majority of the people out there which have departed from the faith, at least when it comes to the having of multiple wives, in that by custom and by law society is forbidding women to marry. Forbidding women to marry. The forbidding to marry, of course, are Paul's words, not mine. And this brings to mind the report I mentioned earlier, located in Christianity Magazine. Of course, this pertained to the United Kingdom, but it just well applies over here, which said that church-going women are forced to stay single because they cannot find partners who match their high moral standards. Now, this is pathetic. This is pathetic. Church-going women are forced to stay single because they cannot find partners who match their high moral standards. And Paul says that some shall depart from the faith, forbidding to marry. And I don't think there's any doubt, because certainly custom and laws have made it impossible for them to find partners and marry. And to me, the results are the same. They are still forbidden to marry. They're forbidding these women to marry. So in conclusion of this entire study, then, man's customs and man's laws are forbidding women to marry. And what this does is to deny those women the remedy of marriage that God gave them to prevent immorality. And this is denied to women by supposedly fellow Christians. My friends, under these circumstances, there is no reason at all why we should be surprised if Christian women stumble into fornication, if women stumble into adultery situations and marriages with the ungodly. There's no reason for us to be surprised when our Christian women stumble into fornication, adultery, and marriages with the ungodly. And while such stumbling is their own responsibility, we have to put it all on their shoulders in that sense. We also need to face the fact that their stumbling is a direct result of our unscripturally forbidding men to have more than one wife. There are only two solutions to the massive imbalance of our population. Number one is to kill all the men and women over the age of, say, 30 or 25 or 30 who are not married. And, of course, that's simply not a possible solution, but it would solve the problem. The only other solution is we can return to the biblical standard of men being able to have more than one wife. Otherwise, each of us must accept the blame for allowing a situation to exist which causes other Christians to stumble. Well, that's it for today. But before I close, if you are a first-time listener and would like to receive information pertaining to this ministry, let me invite you to send for our introduction package. Please send your request to Gospel Ministries, P.O. Box 9411, Boise, Idaho, 83707. Don't put it off. Write for it today. That's Gospel Ministries, P.O. Box 9411, Boise, Idaho, 83707. To our regular listeners, I would like to remind you that Saturdays are prayer days around here. And at 9 a.m. every Saturday morning, that's Mountain Standard Time, we bring the needs of the people and the ministry before the Lord. So if you have a prayer request, be sure and send it in to us. And again, I invite you to join us at 9 a.m. For even though we are separated by long distances, we can still be together in prayer at the same time. Write to us if you're so inclined, as we do enjoy hearing from you, and many of you ask Bible questions which we are more than happy to answer by mail.